from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a new chapter in China's political history is about to begin. The once-a-decade transition of power gets underway later this week. And in the hour ahead, we'll look toward what the changes are apt to mean, not only for China, but for the world as a new government makes its way into power. We'll have a panel and include your calls and questions and comments. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. China's Communist Party is getting ready for a leadership transition, something that happens once every decade. And starting November 8th, a new generation of party leaders will begin to take the helm. Who will become the new top officials and how might the shift affect U.S.-China relations? We want to take all that up and more in this morning's opening Forum Hour. And first, we want to go to Beijing and welcome Jocelyn Ford, who is an independent journalist and a Beijing-based journalist who has reported from Beijing since 2001. Jocelyn Ford, good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, welcome. I guess at this point, I'm wondering if you can characterize what the feeling is there, and I mean in the broadest sense, but also we talked with Orville Schell earlier, and he said things are very tense and on edge, and yet the transition supposedly has been fait accompli. It's decided who's going to take the helm, hasn't it?
Been. And if you ask about the mood, I must say, as soon as I go out my door, I notice it on the streets. There's a massive police presence. Something like 60,000 police have been brought in from neighboring provinces. And, you know, every overpass, you see them hanging out there. Having said that, when you've lived here long enough, you know, no longer feel so threatening. And you sort of get used to this when major events happen. So that's sort of the first thing you notice. And the second thing is the city is covered with these banners saying, long live the Communist Party, extolling the wonderful, the amazing achievements of the party over the past decades, and posters of Communist Party heroes and that sort of thing. So you know, though the city is festooned, you don't feel, it's not much of a festivity feeling around town. In fact, another thing which is sort of interesting is an absence of discussion about the Congress. I probably hear more talk about the U.S. election than I do about what's going on in Chinese politics.
And yet, there really is no, even though the leadership will be changing, there's no central leader in the way they're high leader, for example, the way there has been in past decades. And from what I understand, this is causing some concern.
Well, certainly within, you know, the intellectual circles and the political discussion, the question of how the next leader is picked is very much up in the air, because, you know, back in the days of Chairman Mao or Deng Xiaoping, the party elders who held a lot of clout, they sort of appointed the next generation. And as there's no longer, politicians with that sort of stature. So we're seeing a bit of change this time in how the politicians will be chosen to fill the top seats.
Is there any anticipation that there will be bigger changes? I mean, there's been certainly a lot of talk about political reform and restructuring the political system, both in and out of the party itself. What's your sense generally about whether things will loosen up or whether there'll be a clamp down?
What's interesting, because today I was out interviewing a bunch of people who do government relations for multinationals here, and they were overwhelmingly positive, at least the Chinese nationals who fill this job and really, I think, have their finger on the pulse of how politics works here. And basically what they said was that the outgoing leader, President Hu Jintao, really was not comfortable with foreigners. He didn't have much of an international experience or a business background. And that sort of trickled down through the whole bureaucracy. And for the past few years, foreign companies have felt rather unwelcome and had a tough time, whereas the incoming leader has had a lot of experience in the eastern provinces where they're more developed and have more private industry. He's more familiar with that. Of course, he's spent some time in Iowa, is famously known, and has maintained relations with the family there that he stayed with many years ago, and he's sort of seen as a more outgoing guy, and that was seen as a very positive. That there may be new possibilities, they may be more friendly towards private business. So that was the feeling I was getting today, but we're not going to know for another year or so. He's got to consolidate power. He doesn't actually take power until next March. And so time will tell.
Well, we thank you for joining us, and we're going to continue, obviously, to keep our eyes on China. It is certainly, if not, well, I don't know. People keep saying it's eclipsing the United States as a great power in the world right now, but it's still a competition, and I think that has, in terms of the denouement, that is far off in the future. A lot may have to do with our own election. I want to thank you, Jocelyn Ford, for joining us, however, and appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much. And if I may just have one last word, if you were to come to China today and I were to show you many corners of the country, you would not feel that China was eclipsing the United States at this point. If you read the headlines and see the image that China is portraying itself as, you may have that feeling. But come visit on the ground and you'll see there's a long way to go yet.
Well, especially out in the rural areas, I know how impoverished it still is there, and there is a lot of way to go, particularly with respect to freedom. But again, I thank you for joining us. China's economy has been slipping somewhat. Again, Jocelyn Ford's a Beijing-based journalist who's reported from Beijing since 2001, and the slippage in the economy, with respect, nevertheless, of the United States being terribly indebted to China, makes China a very important player on the global scene and very important for the United States and its destiny, regardless of who is elected today. We may not get the results till much later today. We'll have to wait and see. But let me tell you about the others who are joining us in this hour. We want to, in fact, welcome to the program Xiao Jiang, who is chief editor of the China Digital Times. He's also adjunct professor in the School of Information at UC Berkeley and joins us from the Berkeley campus. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also, I want to say good morning. It's actually afternoon in Syracuse or near Syracuse. Gordon Chang joining us, author of The Coming Collapse of China, contributor to Forbes.com. Gordon Chang, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we're also welcoming Peter Kwong to this panel, distinguished professor of Asian American Studies and Urban Affairs at Hunter College at City University of New York, joining us from Lower Manhattan, where thankfully, gratefully, there is once again electricity. Peter Kwong, good to have you.
Thank you very much.
And let me begin, Professor Kwong, with you, if I may. There are dozens of senior positions that are going to be fought over. There's a lot of talk about backroom politics here and maybe the black box that we can't penetrate. We'll find out more about that in the course of this hour. That is how things enigmatically are done in terms of this ascension of leadership. But nine are in this leadership collective to begin with, and there are rumors that that's going to be reduced, and yet there's all this horse trading that we really don't even know about.
Well, yes, this is something quite unusual. Something like this in the past, long arranged and agreed upon, and everybody already by now know who these seven people would be. But this has been a very, very difficult transition. There's all these infighting, not only just infighting inside, but fighting outside, information coming out. Scandals, corruption of Wen Jiabao, for instance, last week came out in New York Times. These are unheard of kind of problems. The lack of discipline within the highest level of Chinese Communist Party, and that's why it's quite worrisome. And it shows that there, even though the transition is coming. But not everybody is very happy.
Well, it's kind of like a billionaire boys' club almost, especially when you read about the scandals involving Bo Xilai and the rail minister taking bribes up to excess of $100 million and the kind of just money that has been accumulated by these so-called princelings who are in high office.
That's right, including Xie, who is going to be the chairman. Recently, there's an article about his family connections. And so the issue here is quite stark, that everybody knows that there's got to be political reforms. And that was what was promised 10 years ago and never happened. So the pressure becomes even more so. And the popular opposition, riots, demonstration is getting bigger, larger, and more daring. At the same time, you're seeing a situation the Communist Party is corrupt to the core, that what they're doing now is the party leaders want to stay in power and maintaining and expanding the spoil. And so this is two contradictory challenge. One is we have to reform. One is we have to keep what we have and, in fact, getting more. So this is why the split is indicative.
It's also very fragmented. I mean, they keep talking about the princelings, those who have revolutionary bona fides in their lineage and all of that, but they also talk a good deal, those who are China watchers, about the populist movement. And,
that's right.
There's factions within the factions.
Yeah, Bo Xilai, for instance, is a faction wanting to go back, at least from the surface point of view, to a more socialist kind of ideological orientation. Then you have the populist, Wen Jiabao is one. And then you have people who are simply interested in occupying strategic positions in order to gain more spoil. And so even in the princelings, you have all these different factions. That's why the kind of transition is not a unified one. And all the more they have to propagandize that they are united, but in fact they are not. And that's what you hear all the time from all the people coming out and talking about the divisions, the kind of constantly who's after who.
Peter Kwong, again with us from New York City, is Distinguished Professor of Asian American Studies and Urban Affairs at Hunter College. And Gordon Chang is author of The Coming Collapse of China, contributor to Forbes.com. Gordon, it's going to be perhaps a number of years before this leadership is even consolidated, huh?
I think it'll take quite some time. And the reason is that Chinese transitions usually take many years. We've seen the infighting at the top this past year, but normally it takes about 2 years for new Chinese leaders to consolidate their position. So we're talking 2014 or so. But we've got to remember there are three transitions. There's the transfer of the Secretary General, the General Secretary of the Communist Party. That's going to occur now. You have the transfer of the presidency, which occurs next March. And then there's the transfer of the chairmanship of the Central Military Commission, and there's no specified time for that. And many people are saying that Hu Jintao, the current leader, who is also chairman of the Central Military Commission, doesn't want to give up that post. And it may take 2 years, may take 5 years for him to give that up. So we're talking about many years before the leadership position in Beijing gets settled. And while that occurs, you have all of these very important challenges that Peter talked about that the Communist Party is facing. And so the party must face and deal with these challenges at a time when it's least able to do so, which is in the middle of a very messy transition.
And also, as I said, a declining economy. And what about all the corruption that we've been reading about? I mean, to some extent, are they going to try to maybe exercise some of that or get rid of it?
Well, they always try to do that. There have been anti-corruption campaigns in the People's Republic since 1951, just 2 years after it was founded. And they have not been able to do it. And of course they can't, because you have an unaccountable political system, and you also have a government that is too much involved in the economy. People are making decisions that the market should make. So when you have those two things together, excessive government involvement in the economy plus an unaccountable political system, you're going to have rampant corruption. There's not going to be the structural change that is necessary in China. We're not going to see it within the context of the People's Republic. And yes, they'll talk about fighting corruption. They'll talk about their other problems as well, but they're not making progress. They're not even implementing the obvious solutions at this point, which really means that this is a political system that is paralyzed and it's not able to do what's necessary.
when you talk about a political system that's paralyzed and not able to do what's necessary, I guess a lot of it also has to do, I would assume, with the fact that it doesn't have unified leadership. It's a weaker leadership.
Every leader of the People's Republic has been weaker than his predecessor. You know, there's no Mao Zedong or Deng Xiaoping, a strong man, to enforce discipline. And that's why we've seen this excessive infighting. You know, at the beginning of this year, virtually every China watcher said that this transition would be smooth because the Communist Party had institutionalized itself with rules, guidelines, practices, and limits. But, you know, as we've seen, that was completely wrong. That was the narrative that the world wanted to hear. And even critics of the regime accepted that storyline. But, you know, without a strong leader, there is too much infighting. And we're going to see basically three strong leaders going forward. There's going to be Xi Jinping, the new general secretary and president, Hu Jintao, who probably will still remain as chairman of the Central Military Commission, and Jiang Zemin, who was the leader before Hu Jintao, who now exercises very substantial influence in what goes on. And that really means a confusion because you don't know who's in charge.
But I'm also reading that there are some analysts in Beijing who say that Hu is in a weaker position than Jiang and may not retain the post.
Yes. Well, you know, many people are saying that the new Politburo Standing Committee, which is the group of seven or nine guys who run the country, is going to be dominated by people selected by Jiang Zemin, not Hu Jintao, but Jiang Zemin. And that really means we're going to see the conservatives come back. We are going to see really very little move toward reform because the people who like the way things are going to be calling the shots. They'll have at least four seats on the Politburo Standing Committee, which will probably be seven people, and that's an absolute majority. And it really means then that Jiang Zemin is going to be pulling the strings, and that's going to be irritating not only Xi Jinping but Hu Jintao. This is a recipe for a disaster for the Communist Party.
Gordon Chang, again with us from near Syracuse, author of The Coming Collapse of China and contributor to Forbes.com. And Xiao Cheng is chief editor of the China Digital Times. He's also adjunct professor at the School of Information here at UC Berkeley. And Professor Chang, you know, this is I use this metaphor that's often used of the black box, how difficult it is to really see what's going on behind the scenes in China and to glean information there. But with the Internet, there isn't quite the lockdown that there's been in the past, and people maybe are more, is it safe to say, getting information, it's more accessible to them, especially to people in the streets, potentially?
Yes, that's the short answer. We heard the previous commentators mention several times that this leadership transition, highest leadership transition in China, happened in a way that very messy because of the, without a pre-political strongman's pre-arrangements. However, there is another aspect of this transition happening in context, which is this is the first time that happening in, I would say, when the Internet age arrives in China, even compares with 10 years ago, the information and communication technologies, pervasive penetration in Chinese society, makes the public opinion, particularly the urban, educated, well-to-do middle-class voices, are being really strongly heard in the society. Yes, on the one hand, the people have no say to those highest power, political power transition. People have no role to play. You know, people cannot vote. People don't know anything about those black boxes really happening other than access the propaganda machine. But on the other hand, people can compare with the information they get from the Internet, even information outside the country, and those what we call the sort of underground rumors and tips. And people do express their genuine feelings and critiques, even in the forms of satire, jokes, mockery, under the context of censorship, but still people's voice are clearly being heard this time in this transitional period.
So they've got to be concerned, this new leadership, and during the transition of maybe that's why the police presence is so strong, as we heard from Jocelyn Ford in Beijing, about, well, not necessarily something like Tiananmen Square, but at least the possibility of people reacting, and reacting perhaps the way they did to the in the Green Revolution in Iran, something along those lines?
Well, I think that may be a little too strong to categorize, but at least we can explain that why in the leadership, in the Chinese politicians, you have those what we call the populists, whether it's Bo Xilai, who trying to appear on the traditional Maoist socialist ideological side, or Premier Wen Jiabao, who appears on the liberal and more political reformer side. Both of them are trying to make appeal to the public opinion in China. And, of course, now we know both of them are economically very corrupted, not even mentioning other things, because that is by the very nature.
There's also the big scandal that was involving Bo Xilai's wife and so forth that has made him, I guess he's going to be having charges brought against him. His wife was already tried and convicted. But I'm also wondering about, you know, you had Leon Panetta saying that China is trying to conduct some cyber warfare against the United States. What does this transition mean, in your judgment, for ongoing relations with the United States, or for that matter, with the West in general?
Well, the China's in the past 30 years, the basic context of economic rise is being very cooperative with the United States in terms of economic and global trade, and of course that extends to other issues. But the friction is always there, fundamentally because there is a one-party dictatorship, authoritarian regime. Its political value and the practice is very questionable in the today's world, democratic world, and the United States is a leader of this world. Given that is a sort of in a general context, the coming leader, President Xi Jinping, maybe after he consolidated his power, must also handle the China and the U.S. relation with extremely care, giving. He has to handle his political domestic affairs well. He has to consolidate his power. He has to come out with some kind of new agenda, probably include some of the political reform, at least rhetorics, and then we'll see what kind of a domestic progress he can make. And then probably that decides what his foreign policy will be. He could also write a nationalism platform. That's another populist way to go, which means a tougher position towards foreign forces, and then they can play up issues such as with Japan or with Taiwan, which implies the United States, causing tension if they want to use that to shift attention from the domestic crisis.
Well, there are a lot of questions in the air here with this transition of power. We have our own election here in the United States, but China, by the end of the week, will have gone through this process or will begin the process. As Gordon Chang said, it's going to be a long consolidation, no doubt. And you may have questions. Chinese Communist Party getting ready for leadership transition, something that happens every decade, and starting November 8th, a new generation of party leaders will actually begin to take the helm. We're talking about what that means not only domestically for China, but with respect to geopolitical relations abroad. You can join us, and if you have questions or comments, we invite you to do that. A lot of questions, of course, with respect to this transition of power. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, Internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program, and again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and join us that way with any questions or comments, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, perhaps The Economist said it best in quoting, well, a number of scholars who were meeting in China. with a recent conference saying China is unstable at the grassroots, dejected in the middle strata, and out of control at the top. But we're talking about what's in the future for China, particularly with the Chinese Communist Party getting ready for a leadership transition. And you may have some questions and concerns that you want to bring up here. In fact, we welcome your calls and your emails, and you can join the conversation. Whenever one talks about China, of course, inevitably questions of human rights come up, but also questions of trade and currency and a new government. Well, what does it all mean in those terms? What does it mean for China internally, particularly with censorship and concern about just general civil liberties that have been ongoing in China for all these years, free press and the like, question of land privatization, of the judicial system and so forth. We've got three China experts with us. Peter Kwong is a distinguished professor of Asian American Studies and Urban Affairs at Hunter College at the City University of New York. And Gordon Chang is author of The Coming Collapse of China and contributor to Forbes.com. And Xiao Cheng is chief editor of the China Digital Times and adjunct professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley. We also spoke earlier with Jocelyn Ford, who's an independent journalist located in Beijing, and she spoke with us from there. And lots of fighting going on, as in back rooms, certainly, in this black box that is often used as a metaphor for Chinese politics. If you'd like to join the conversation again, we welcome your calls. It's toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our handle at Twitter is @KQEDForum. And you might just want to note what you feel is shaping up for China's future. Our Facebook page is available to you as well, and so is our website, kqed.org/forum. Timothy writes on our Facebook page, "What is being said about China can also be said about Washington," followed by a number of exclamation marks. And let's go to your calls. And we begin, Chris, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Fascinating conversation. Thank you for having it. Thank you for letting me participate. I was curious to hear your thoughts on it's obvious since it's happening at the same time, but very different systems of transfer of power, and yet, you know, two completely divergent, competing sometimes systems of government. But what do you make of the tendency of both of them towards the same thing, at least in the case, in my view, of Governor Romney, governing by privileged elites for the benefit of the few as opposed to the benefits of the many?
Well, that's pretty much what's consistently been gleaned about the princelings, hasn't it, Gordon Chang?
There is a feeling that those people who have been really privileged because their fathers and mothers have been senior officials or generals are now basically have an access that others don't have. And this is different, I think. You know, there's a lot of comparisons one can make between the United States and China, and certainly, you know, your callers point about Governor Romney, but, you know, it's very unlikely to have someone like a Barack Obama be able to become the leader of the country. That just doesn't seem to be too possible in China these days, because Xi Jinping, who is going to become the next supremo, you know, had a father who was considered one of the eight immortals of the People's Republic. And so clearly you're dealing with people who have had this access. Bo Xilai, for instance, you know, his father was one of the immortals as well. So essentially what you've got is a political system that is hardening around an elite few. And that's not true of dynamic societies like the United States.
Xi Jinping's father is giving a lot of people hope, though. He was supposed to be a pretty fair-minded man, wasn't he?
Well, yes, but, you know, it doesn't, you know, we focus too much on the personalities of Chinese leaders because we have to remember that they act in a collective system where although Xi Jinping may be considered the most important and he very well may end up being the most powerful, he still has to consult with a lot of people, including people like Jiang Zemin and other leaders of that generation. And also he's within a system that does not allow that much change. So you could put the Pope and make him general party secretary in China, and you might not have very much difference in outcomes if Xi Jinping were the general party secretary or if I were the general party secretary. It's just that we got to remember that it's the nature of the system that is much more important than the personalities, especially at this time when the system is seizing up. and it's really not able to deal with issues. You don't have a strong man there to be able to really change things. Now, I know there's a lot of disadvantages of having a strong man, but nonetheless, what we have right now in China is paralysis, and I don't think any leader, no matter how capable, will be able to change things. So I don't think we should look at personalities.
Well, Peter Kwong, we're talking about what's supposed to be and what always was supposed to be a collective leadership, aren't we?
That's right. And it has always been a collective leadership from the beginning, except that they still do have internal fightings. And oftentimes those internal fighting is fought behind. A lot of people don't know what happened only years later. Now you have a couple of situations where those things did break out. Cultural revolution is one. But today we are really talking about open discourse, disagreements, and they play out in all kinds of ways that tells us that a decision that's made at the highest level, not necessarily able to force everybody to agree to, and they would use all kinds of ways to bypass that. So the point I think we need to make is that a party that is so corrupt that the previous caller in terms of comparing the United States, well, I think the United States have been doing quite poorly in terms of regulations, in terms of, but there's still a legal systems, however imperfect. But in the case of China, the Chinese Communist Party is everything. They're the legislator, they're the executive, they're the judicial. So,
and the military.
And the military. So they could do whatever they want to do if their vital interest is involved. And so when you talk about corruption in the United States, insider trading, for instance, well, in China, that's basically everything is insider trading. You will use your political position, occupied strategic board a directorship in state-owned enterprises, and just take over the company splitting the shares among yourselves, or using your power in the market to monopolize certain part of the economy.
Why the princelings are so sympathetic to free market reform, supposedly.
It is, on the other hand, they don't want regulations. There is no regulations. The freedom, the market economy allow them to take advantage of the free expanding, tremendously expanding economy. The wealth of economy that the last 30 years have generated is huge. And yet, if you look at the statistics, it's all accumulated in very, very small group of people. And all the billionaires, they are all connected. And nobody does not have protection or part of the party is able to have any access to that wealth.
So this is what I think it's safe to say, Xiao Cheng, we're talking about an oligarchy here, aren't we?
We are, but it's also becoming more and more apparent in the information age. If you listen to the internet, what the people are saying, demanding greater transparency and accountability is the most clearest voice in the Chinese society.
Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go next to you. Tyler, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, because I'm sure China is looking to our political system and looking to exploit maybe some of our political unrest. Is that reciprocal with China? Do we find that their infighting is actually, does that help our position with them, or is it no different?
Xiao Cheng?
Well, this is the way I talk about two very different political system, right? As I said before, in the authoritarian regime, we do not know what's the at the highest level what's in a closed-door power broking the process, how exactly happened. But we do know any government that requires a certain amount of legitimacy to rule the country. And in China, the legitimacy is solely based, since it's not democratically elected, legitimacy of the party depends on its performance. Depends on the economic performance, but it's also dependent on its political performance.
What are the standards of judgment of political performance? I mean,
why? That's right. One of the judgment is will be, for example, social justice, the distribution of the wealth. If large amount of people are unhappy about this, those kind of anger and resent will accumulate. And they are sort of breaking through in a society in a small corners the one way or another. Even there's a large police machine trying to sort of suppress such local conflicts. But the general mood in the society is demanding a greater political change.
Well, I was talking before about how poor it is out in the rural areas, and yet one might make note of the fact that about 95% of Chinese now have some health coverage, and the economy quadrupled its size under Hu Jintao, just in terms of dollars. But if it's slipping, then it does raise questions about, well, how the people are going to respond, particularly in this digital age, information age. Let me go to Walnut Creek and get Elan on here. Good morning. Or is it Ethan? I'm sorry.
Emham,
I'm sorry.
Yes, I just had a quick question. Before, the leaders used to be civil engineers by profession or some type of an engineer. And I was just wondering if there has been any change in terms of the professions. Are there more lawyers now, more educators, or are there still the same professions as they used to be, mostly engineers?
And what do we know about that, Peter Kwong?
Well, they are still generally in the sciences, that is one reason being that there is a whole belief that somehow if you're in science, you are good for economy and development and all that kind of stuff. There are some people who are moving into social sciences, although if you look at the Political Bureau and you look at the Central Committee, many, many people have doctoral degrees. And these doctorate degrees are quite questionable because, well, anyway, a lot of times these people get a doctorate degree not necessarily doing their own work. But in any event, there is a broadening, definitely an increased education level of the top leaders. Many of them are trained in the United States and Europe. So if we're talking about education level, I think this is a much better educated group of leaders.
Well, what about that education in the West, Gordon Chang? I mean, does it give them, we heard a lot, for example, about Middle Eastern leaders who were educated in the West and how it would change politics and maybe free things up and perhaps even lead to some more democratization. Certainly, Syria is a good example of that being just the opposite in terms of what the expectations or hopes were. What about China?
This is really important in the sense that, yes, you can educate a person, but it doesn't necessarily say what type of leader they will be. Because we, you know, United States, around the world, you have some very good leaders who didn't have education, and you've got some pretty bad leaders who had, you know, doctorates. So really what I think is the important thing is not to focus on the personalities so much as to, or the, even the outlooks of Chinese leaders, but to look at the system. Because with this collective system, with the way that it operates, it doesn't really translate in terms of education or outlook into the way the leaders will govern. And I think that that's an important aspect of this. You know, essentially, you've got a system that is stalled, and because it's stalled, it doesn't matter what an individual thinks, even if that individual is the general secretary.
Gordon, I think what I'm gleaning from your remarks is the hopes that have been pinned on this transition leading to some restructuring of the political system are, shall we say, to put it mildly, fragile.
Yeah, there was 10 years ago a lot of hope that Hu Jintao was a closet reformer and that he would bring China to a much better place. And every time there's a change of leadership, there is always hope in the West. But so far, we've been, you know, our hopes have been dashed. And I think it's important now to look at the context of China. You know, you mentioned before the slowing economy. China doesn't have the 7.4% growth that it claimed in the third quarter of this year. I believe that China is growing at a rate which is comparable to the United States and maybe even less. When you look at indicators such as electricity production, the best indicator of Chinese economic activity, or you look at manufacturing surveys or price indices, this is a real problem for legitimacy, which is what we were talking about before, because legitimacy has really been dependent on the continual delivery of prosperity. And when political systems don't deliver prosperity, then they're in trouble. And they're especially in trouble if they don't have any other props to legitimacy. The only other prop the Communist Party has besides prosperity is nationalism. And that is a very dangerous road.
Well, speaking of nationalism, in fact, Peter Kwong, there is a good deal of increased nationalism over those islands, those uninhabited islands, particularly with some oil being underground. And that conflict has brought China square head-to-head with Japan. Will the transition affect that at all, in your judgment?
Well, definitely. The incidentally, those Diaoyu Island, or Sangaku, including the Japanese call it, this dispute has started in the 1970s, and I was a student then. We were very active in that dispute, condemning Japan, but at the same time, we turn our anger towards nationalist government. That's exactly what's happening today. Yes, that the dispute with Japan is a real one, but it is fueled by people unhappy, wanting to use that as a reason to oppose the government. So, you know, in the demonstration you saw, of all things, they would have Mao's portrait. What does that mean? It means they are remembering the old. They think, you know, the present leaders are incompetent or not aggressive enough. At the same time, too, there is a belief that that the new leaders is not taking care of business, and this is one way of showing to the public that that we have to change, we have to reform. So the whole dispute with Japan is actually internal directed, initially external, but it turns into an internal directed criticism of the present leadership.
At the same time that it's increased nationalism, hasn't it?
That's right. So the danger here is that the Chinese leader, seeing the kind of political unrest, the kind of challenge that's going on, the kind of internal division that's going on, they could decide to use nationalism to diffuse all the criticisms or the attacks. So that's why my article in Nation talk about the fact that it is a political rhetoric from the point of view of the two American candidates attacking China. China bashing is a tool to win Ohio voters, but that is certainly will have a very unexpected impact if the Chinese leader felt cornered and they have to get themselves out of this internal and external jam. Nationalism would, in fact, be a manifestation.
Let's bring more of your calls on, and I'm going to go to a caller in Sacramento. Catherine, join us.
Good morning.
Hi.
I've been following climate change for a number of years, and certainly our presidential election shied away from the subject. What is China's status in terms of greenhouse gases and air pollution, and how do we get a handle on that? I understand they're very reliant on coal and other fossil fuels, and they have high-speed rail, perhaps, but some of it falls off the viaducts.
Yeah, it's a pretty mixed picture, Xiaocheng, isn't it?
It is. We mentioned before that the Communist Party's today's legitimacy much based on delivering the economic prosperity, which means to keep the economic growth at a certain high-speed level. In order to do that, one thing is you need burn a lot of coal. And that's where when we're talking about a control of the CO2, then climate change collaboration, these are the factors goes into the Chinese rulers' domestic concern that they cannot let their economic growth rate being sort of tamped by such attempt. Although right now the growth is getting slower with even without that concern.
Let me thank the caller, Catherine, for her.
Yeah, I would like to add on that question because right now there is really a lot of consciousness among the Chinese public about environmental issues. You have some huge demonstrations recently, opposition to toxic pipelines going through the cities, for instance. In one demonstration, thousands of people showed up and attacked the city hall and stripped the shirt off the mayor. These are really extreme examples of people that are Chinese people are increasingly aware, increasingly frustrated, increasingly anger about their environmental problems.
No, we've got some of the worst, some of the worst air breathing anywhere in the world in China.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's Matthew who writes on our Facebook page: if we hire Mitt, he will clash completely and fatefully with Xi Jinping from day one, and Xi Jinping will tell him flat out, we will be in for excruciating readjustments and conflicts. If we rehire Brock, the two highly intelligent pragmatists might just set Sino-American relations to the forefront and lead the world on energy and terrorism and aid to the underdeveloped third world. No human knows more about how to lift people through infrastructure, urbanization, research, and education than Xi Jinping. The only area he needs bolstering is the one place Obama is strongest. And another question about nationalism from a listener named Daniel who emails us about national sentiment in China and how it will affect policy going forward. And he says regimes facing loss of legitimacy often seek an external enemy to rally the public around the flag. With the corruption scandals and slowing economic growth and a military man set to take the helm and rising nationalism, we're headed for an extraordinarily dangerous time, in my opinion. And wonder you agree, Gordon Chang?
Well, I certainly do, because one of the things that we've seen over this past year is essentially a delegitimization of the Communist Party, as Cao Chang was talking about. What we have is this terrible stuff starting with Bo Xilai. It's just continued on with other officials. And essentially what this means is that the military is looking at this and actually becoming power brokers as the civilians squabble among themselves. And that means the military is breaking free of civilian control. You have all of the things that your listeners were talking about in terms of nationalism replacing prosperity as the primary basis of legitimacy. I can't think of a more dangerous situation. You know, China is going off the rails. And it really, it sort of means at this point that we don't know where that country is headed, but it doesn't look like it's going towards a good end.
Well, if nationalism increases and if China, under its new government, is looking for, well, scapegoats, if you will, then certainly the issue of Taiwan will rear its ugly head again, too, don't you think, Gordon?
Not so much Taiwan. I think, as we've talked about with Peter mentioned, clearly Japan is a target because there is that historical animosity that goes back even before World War II. You know, Taiwan at this point is run by a government that is actually quite friendly to Beijing. And so I don't see real problems with Taiwan. But we do have issues that China has with South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, India.
And unless we forget Tibet, too.
Well, you have Tibet and Xinjiang, which are parts of China where the inhabitants don't see themselves as Chinese. They see themselves as conquered. They think that the rule from Beijing is extremely harsh. We've had about 55 Tibetans kill themselves through self-immolation. Clearly, things are going wrong, but Beijing has sort of doubled down on its very harsh treatment of its minorities. This is not a good sign. You know, the Tibetans and the Uyghurs can't bring down Beijing, but Beijing is taking on everybody at once, both externally and internally. And the question is, how many enemies does the Chinese Communist Party need? And the answer is, it's got more of them than it can deal with. Its challenges now are greater than its ability. And so I think that we're going into a period where the party's, not only its legitimacy, but also its its survival is very much in stake, in doubt.
And once again, Gordon Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. And let me go to another caller, and that's you, Mike. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call. You've been talking about the potential for the Chinese government to use nationalism to stay in power due to all the challenges they're facing. But one challenge I haven't heard discussed is that there are many more young Chinese men than women in the population. And my question is, how concerned should we be that this overpopulation of young men will drive expansionist policies? And I'm also wondering if there's a historical model of a country that has too many young men and what they've done.
Chao Cheng.
Well, the issue the caller pointed out is mainly the consequences of the one-child policy,
yes,
which was being strictly exercised in throughout the 70s, 80s. And now, on a sociological level, and this becoming a new reality in China. Now, what's the consequences of that? It is unclear. I'm looking at some historical lessons will be extremely useful, especially in the context that we're discussing now, the possibly rising nationalism and domestically the increasing sort of resent towards the distribution of the wealth, the social justice, and the untransparency of the political system.
We're coming toward the end of the hour here, and I want to get a quick response to an email, if I may, from you, Peter Kwong, from a listener named Yu Ming, who says, I don't hear any positive comments by your guests on China's power transfer, which is not fair and misleading. For example, they mentioned power struggle among the older and newer leaders, but many people believe that is China's way to ensure a smooth transfer.
Well, smooth transfer means in a one-party system is very, very important because that is continuity of legitimacy. When you have a situation where the transition coming on and people copying on each other means that that everything is not settled. When you have a one-party power structure, you can't have that. That means not only you don't have legitimacy, you don't have internal unity to present to the public. And that's what the Chinese Communist Party is worrying about.
Well, let us leave it there. It will have to be left there. But I want to thank you, Peter Kwong, a distinguished professor of Asian American Studies and Urban Affairs at Hunter College, for being with us this hour, and Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China, and also Xiao Cheng, chief editor of the China Digital Times and adjunct professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley. We also spoke to Jocelyn Ford, who is an independent journalist. She was with us from Beijing. Thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.